Yeah. The topic tonight is entitled Man Going in the Right Direction. Why is that funny? That's the name of the title. Man Going in the Right Direction.
And that's another one of your jokes.
No, no jokes. And the man, the word man is in quotes.
Oh, wait, mute.
Okay, that's the topic tonight. So let's jump into it. This week, we begin the second book of the Torah, the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot. And as I said last week, it's so hard to imagine that, you know, here it is. We've just finished with all of the patriarchs, matriarchs, and all of the tribes. And boom, here we are in the story of slavery, and Moses comes on the scene. This is how quickly things move. But we are introduced to Moshe in this week's portion. But here's what's interesting. When Moshe, you know, so the Torah tells us very little about his early life. If you read the beginning chapters of this Torah portion, there's really only five stories before his main mission of taking the Jews out of Egypt. There's only five stories. Story number one is his birth, which is premature, and his mother puts him in the basket, puts him in the Nile, and the daughter of Pharaoh saves him. Story number one. The next thing we're told is that he comes outside the palace one day, and he sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew, and he kills the Egyptian. Story number two. Next story, the next day he comes out and he sees two Jews fighting and he tries to break it up and tries to make peace. And they say to him, what, you're going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Moses knows his goose is cooked. He knows that he's in trouble. So story number four is that he runs away. He becomes a fugitive to another country, to the land of Midian. And story number five is he comes to the well. Right, where it's really the end of number four. He comes to the well in Midian and he sees Jethro's daughters. They're as shepherds. The male shepherds are giving them a hard time. So Super Moshe to the rescue, saves them, gives them the flock to drink, and they go home. Dad says, wow, you're home early today. Why are you home so early? So they say, yeah, some Egyptian dude, he helped us out. And he's like, really? Nice guy like that? Why don't you invite him home? Sounds like a great son-in-law. Sure enough, marries one of Yisro's daughters, Zipporah. And story number five is now that he's in the family business, he's out shepherding Jethro's, his father-in-law's sheep, and he comes across the burning bush. God says to him, you the man, you're going to take the Jews out of Egypt. And now our story begins. I just summarized for you 80 years of Moshe's life. How's that? Right? Wouldn't it be great if we studied all of history in this kind of format? We can cover from 1492 all the way to 2021, 7 minutes flat. Okay. But that's all we're told. I have to imagine that there must have been more to the story about Moshe. In fact, if you study in the books of the Midrash, you will see that there's a lot of stories about him, but they're not recorded in the Torah. But I want to focus, and we'll get back to this in a minute. But I want to focus on a particular dialogue that takes place when the daughters of Yisro come back home and their dad says, why are you home so early? Listen to the conversation. Here's where it is. It's in the second chapter of this week's Torah portion. And the minister of Midian had seven daughters. You know, there's a special place in heaven for people like that. The minister of Midian had seven daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's sheep. The shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and saved them and watered their sheep. They came to Reuel, their father. He said, how could you come so quickly today? And they replied, an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds, and he even drew water for us and watered the sheep. He said to his daughters, then where is he? Why'd you leave the man? Summon him and let him eat bread. Let's invite him in. Seems like a pretty straightforward conversation. What did they refer to Moshe as? What was the term that they used about him? An Egyptian man, right? Was he an Egyptian man? Clearly not. But from their perspective, what do they know? They don't know his background. They don't know his genealogy. All they know is some dude who's dressed in Egyptian garb came and saved them. And so they went home and told their father, an Egyptian man, save them. Seems pretty logical. Except for an unexplained reason, for now, the Midrash points out something that is, I think, a tremendous insight about life in general. The Midrash is bothered by the term an Egyptian man. In Hebrew, it's Ish, man, Mitzri, an Egyptian. Ish Mitzri, that's the term that's used. Here's your trivia question that the Midrash actually points out. Your trivia question of the night is, there are only two people in the entire Torah who are given the title Ish something, a man of something, or a certain kind of man, not once, but twice. Let me rephrase the question. You find many places throughout the Torah where somebody is given a title Ish something. He's a man of X or a man from X. But there's only two characters in the entire Torah that have that title Ish something twice. There are
Adam.
Only, I'm sorry, who?
Adam.
Nope. Adam is not one of them.
Ishmael.
Ishmael? Nope. Good guess.
Jacob?
Nope, not Jacob.
Joseph.
Samson?
Who?
Samson?
Samson?
David.
David? Nope.
Noah?
Noah is one of them. Noah is one. That is correct. And we'll look at him in a moment. Noah is one. Who's the other?
Abraham.
Not Abraham. Who, Arlene?
Solomon.
Nope, not Solomon.
You're talking about the whole Tanakh.
Well, at least the five books of the Torah. I wasn't ready to go out on a limb for more than that, but I think it is.
How about Joseph?
How about no?
Who?
Not Joseph.
No. So Noah.
Not Noah Isaac? Is one, and the other is none other than
Moses.
Thank you, Robin. Yes.
Sure, we were making this too hard.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you were going way off. I almost served it to you on a silver platter. Moses.
You already said Moses.
I didn't say Moses.
Oh, I was looking at this.
I
thought so, because you said he was a man of Egypt.
Okay, but that's only one. There's a second place where he's called it a different term, Ish something. Let me explain. Let's take Noah, for example. Okay? When we are first introduced to Noah, the very first sentence of that parsha begins, Ele toldot Noach. These are the offspring of Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. Noach was a righteous man. Ish
of his time.
Tzaddik. Yeah. Good in his time. Generation. Another topic. But the fact is, Noach is called ish tzaddik, a righteous man. However, just a few chapters later, he gets off the ark. And what does he do? Infamously, he plants a vineyard and he gets drunk.
That's a wine vineyard.
A wine vineyard, that's correct. Here's what it says. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Yafed, Ham being the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah. Fine. Noah, Vayochel Noach, Noach planted or debased himself. Who is this Noach? Ish ha'adama, a man of the earth. Notice it says ish something. There's a change. Ish tzaddik, a righteous man, to ish ha'adama, a man of the earth. Okay, it's an interesting observation. But so what? Well, Let's contrast it with our character, Moshe. I quoted for you the first one. When the daughters of Yisrael go back home, they refer to him and he's called Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man. However, at the very end of Moses' life, at the very end of the Torah, where most of us have forgotten what his original title was given, because, you know, four books later, the Torah actually refers to Moshe as, anybody want to guess? I'll help you. It's the first sentence in the last portion of Zot HaBracha. It says, V'zot HaBracha, and this is the blessing, Asher Beirach Moshe, that Moses blessed. Which Moses? Ish HaElokim, man of God. Ish HaElokim, the man of God blessed at B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, before he died. Moshe and Noach are the only two who are given the term Ish something twice. Yes, Liz.
Abraham and Joshua were both given the Yud in their name when they were like elevated.
Well, not Avram. Avram was given a hey.
A hey. Okay. But so were they not ever referred to as a man of any?
Not twice.
But once.
Some yes, some no.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I just thought that was a big deal that they got an extra letter.
It is.
But they didn't necessarily get the...
Not necessarily.
The honorific or
no,
whatever.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
But Noach and Moshe are the only two that I'm aware of that actually have the title twice. And the Midrash makes a fascinating observation. What direction is Noach going in? The original introduction of Noach to us is, it probably doesn't get much higher than this, of Ish Tzadik, a righteous man. In fact, he was the only one, he and his very immediate family are the only ones worthy of being saved from the entire world. He's a very righteous individual. Yet, getting off the ark, the Torah alludes to the fact that he has been downgraded. He is now called Isho Adama, a man of the earth. Now you can say simply, which is not untrue, and that is Noach is the one who now is working the field, is working the earth. In fact, the whole earth is around because Noah saved the animals, himself. They're able to work. That's all true. But for the Medrash sees something much deeper. It's analyzing the text and saying, why didn't the Torah just say Noah planted his vineyard? We know the rest of the story. Why give him a title? Ish HaAdama, a man of the earth. It must be stressing something more and wants us to contrast what he was to what he is now, what he became. Sadly, as great as Noah was, he became lowered. He took a step down as far as his level. He's going in an opposite, he's going in a downward direction. Compare and contrast that with Moshe. Moshe is introduced to us with the first title as an Egyptian man. Okay, it's a true fact. In their mind, he was nothing more than a guy dressed in Egyptian garb, and he came to save them, so they referred to him. But the fact that the Torah records the conversation wants to impress upon us the level at which Moshe was to what he ultimately became, an Ish HaElokim, a man of God, that's got to go up a few rungs on the ladder. Moshe is going in an upward growth-oriented pattern in that direction. And unfortunately, Noach had reached a certain height on his ladder and now was going downward. This is a fascinating idea. I'll read you the words of the Midrash itself. Rabbi Barachia said, Moshe is more beloved in the eyes of God than Noah. Initially, when God informed Noah that his family alone had been chosen to survive the flood, he was called a righteous man. Now he had become yet a man of the earth. In contrast to Moshe, who initially was referred to as an Egyptian man, but was ultimately called a man of God. What a great insight that the Midrash is sharing with us. If you want to know the basic difference between a Noah mentality and a Moses mentality, is what direction in life are you going? Are you growing or not? And in case you want to get technical with me and say, but Rabbi, there's something in between. I don't necessarily have to be growing, nor do I have to necessarily be regressing. I can just be. Somebody once said to me, that's Rabbi, you don't always have to work so hard. That's why we're called human beings. We're not called human doings. I said, no, sorry, I don't buy it. Yes, but the point isn't just to be. In Judaism, from a Torah perspective, you have only two options. You're either growing in an upward, growth-oriented manner, or by default, you are regressing. There are many places in Judaic literature where the Jewish people are compared to birds. A fascinating piece of information regarding birds. How do they reach the highest elevations? They flap their wings. They start on the ground. I don't know how they physically do it, but they get off the ground and they're flapping their wings and they can soar like eagles to the highest heights. Yeah, and then what? What's the next step? When they stop flapping their wings, what happens? No, they coast. They coast for a very short while. They can do that. But if they don't flap their wings again, they will, because of the laws of gravity, they will start coming down. As I've said many times, the laws of the physical universe are true because they mirror and reflect a truth in the spiritual laws. The same way that a bird, for it to elevate itself to a higher level, needs to put in the effort of flapping its wings and for a short period of time can coast at that level. But if more effort is not put in, even just to maintain that level, then by definition, by default, we start to come down. Mm-hmm. Moshe is a growth-oriented person. Noach, unfortunately, did it for quite some time, but then switched. This is not just an important idea in life, which it is. But for us as a Jewish people, it's even more critical because you've heard the expression, I'm sure, that we are known as the people of the book. Have you heard that expression? Right? It's terrible. Yes. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. Because we're not the people of the book. We're the people of constant reading, growing. Marsha, I was plotzing when you were telling me, you know, that's a great word, Yiddish. Yiddish means I was bursting at the seams when you were telling me that in your spare time, how much you're reading and catching up. And I'm like, yes, what a segue to tonight's conversation. Because that's who we are. We do not laud ourselves and pride ourselves on reading a book. That's not, it's constantly reviewing it, learning more, growing more, picking up the next one. Don't just limit it and say we're the people of the book, you know, the coffee table edition that sits there and picks up dust. That's not who we are. When you finish that book, what do we do when we finish reading the Torah? What's
start over.
Not even the next week. Same day, we start again. Why? Because that's how we do it. It's constant growth. I'll go so far as to say that the survival of us as a people depends on this. It really does. You know, we've spoken many times the fact that God created mankind with two components, There's a body and a soul. And just as the body needs nourishment and energy and a source of giving it life, so does your soul. Your soul needs soul food. And it's not something you pick up at Walmart. It's not something you can pick up anywhere, except the way to nurture your soul is to give it its nourishment. How do you give your soul nourishment? Growing in wisdom, understanding, developing yourself higher and higher. Franz Rosenzweig. Sound familiar to anybody? Great philosopher. Can't say I agree with all of his points, but nevertheless, makes a fascinating point. He says, to have found God is not an end, but is in itself a beginning. Beautiful, beautiful idea. Most of us spend a lifetime, quote, trying to find God in our life, which is a great pursuit. But even when, quote unquote, we become comfortable with that and we found God, now the job first begins. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to deepen your understanding? Are you going to enrich your life with a greater appreciation in nurturing that relationship? Of course. It's just starting. The first word in the Torah, Bereshit, it's only the beginning. Wow, amazing. And we've seen it how many times in our life? Every year we start again, reminding we're still at the beginning. There's more to learn because that's what it's all about. The primary avenue or the primary source of nourishing your soul is the Torah, obviously, because that's God's wisdom. There can be no greater, you know, yoga for the soul, Pilates for the spirit, however you want to phrase it. But that's what your soul needs. It needs that oomph. It needs that. I think I quoted this to you not that long ago with an understanding of just how vital Torah study is for the Jewish people. I'm pretty sure I quoted it. There was back in 1940, there was a directive straight from the Gestapo headquarters in Krakow. In 1940, the directive read as follows. It was sent out to all of the Germans. Do not permit Jews to leave Poland. Many of these Jews are rabbis and Talmud scholars who will go to the United States and teach other Jews. Each Eastern European Jew is a valued member of the Talmud Society, and they will make every effort to spiritually renew the Jews in America. This must not be allowed. Yeah. It's sad. We don't recognize it, but they did. This is the lifeblood of our people. If we're not growing, we're not living. We have to constantly grow. There are many, many such examples about the recognition. There are verses that say where Torah and mitzvot are our life and the length of our days. We talk about many stories about the great Rabbi Akiva. I think I've shared this as well. You know, Baruch Hashem, thank God I've been teaching and for many years, and I can't always remember who I told what to anymore. And when it comes fast and furious, I don't remember if it was last week or last year. But maybe I shared this piece of Talmud with you. The Roman government had decreed that Jews were not allowed to engage in the study of Torah. That was one of the decrees under the Roman rulership. And there was a fellow by the name of Pappus. Pappus, the son of Yehuda, came and he found Rabbi Akiva as he was convening assemblies to teach Torah. Pappus said to him, Akiva, are you not afraid of the regime? Are you not afraid that the Romans will find you and punish you? Rabbi Akiva replied to him. He says, let me give you an analogy. The analogy is comparable to a fox walking alongside a river. Right? I think I did share this with you. Yeah. Alongside the river. And he saw fish that were gathering from place to place, all agitated. And the fox said, what are you running away from? And they said, well, the nets that people are bringing to catch us. So the fox said, so then why don't you come up on dry land and we'll dwell together, you and I. Yeah, sure. fish said to them, you're the one that you're considered such a clever animal. You're so clever. You're not clever at all. You're foolish. Because if in the climate that sustains us in the water, we're afraid. In a climate which will absolutely induce our death, all the more so. Rabbi Akiva said, if, right, this is what he said, if now, as we sit and study the Torah, about which it's written, it's the length of our days, nevertheless, we're threatened by danger. If we proceed to absent ourselves from Torah, we disconnect from it, our chances of survival are nil. This is what it is. We have to continue growing. This is a Moshe mentality. But there's more. There's more to this. I want to show you another aspect of this comparison where Moshe goes from an Egyptian man to a godly man, to a man of God. Again, we are told based on, as I said earlier, if you look at the first 80 years of Moshe's life, we don't know much. It's those five stories. As I said, when this fugitive saves the daughters of Yisro, right? And he asks, why are you home so early? They said, Ich Mitzri Hitzilanu, an Egyptian man saved us. The Medrash, again, on this verse, has such a great insight. It tells an analogy of a man who's walking along. Let's see if I have it quoted here. 1 second. I didn't print it out, but I know it. Okay. The analogy is of a man who's walking along the seashore. And he's minding his own business. And all of a sudden, he's bitten by a scorpion. Snake. So he immediately runs to the water to try to wash out the poison. And as he's doing that, and he's hopefully being successful, he sees a child in the distance who's drowning. So quickly, he runs further into the water and he saves the child. And he brings him back to his parents. The parents are just ecstatic and they can't thank you. Please, we can't thank you enough for saving our son. He says, don't thank me. Thank the scorpion, because if the scorpion had not bitten me, I would not have gone to the water and I would not have seen your child. This analogy is what the Medrash quotes as the conversation between Moshe and the daughters of Yisro. What do you mean? They come home and they say, Dad, this Egyptian man saved us. You know what? Where did they get that idea from? Either because he was dressed as one, that's the simple understanding, or, says the Midrash, Moshe taught them a valuable lesson. They came to him and they said, thank you for saving us from those shepherds. Thank you for protecting us. And thank you for going even further and watering and giving drink to our sheep and our flock. And you know what Moshe's reply to them was? Don't thank me. Thank the Egyptian man. Thank the Egyptian man. What Egyptian man? They said. What are you talking about? He said, oh, let me fill you in on a little background. Do you know why I'm here? Do you know why I'm in Midian right now and why I'm a fugitive out of Egypt? It's because I killed an Egyptian man because he was beating up a Jew and I had to run for my life. Don't thank me. I'm only here because of that dead Egyptian who I killed. Think about it. I know it sounds funny. I know that we're playing. It's such a profound lesson about giving credit where credit is really due. How often in life we finish doing something or we take care of something and we are applauded for our efforts. But how did we get there? How did we get into that position to even do it? Didn't somebody come before me who set it all up? I'm sharing these great insights with you. You think I did all the research on this? Du bist mishiga? Are you crazy? I use books, lots and lots of books. Who did all the research? I'm just coming along in 2021 and sharing their insights. Ish Mitzri, you know what? It was really the Egyptian man who saved you. Yeah, you got to look a little deeper. For those of you who have been coming to my Olivet class, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Looking deeper, penetrating, using your eye in your eye, right? Moshe is telling him, telling the girls, you cannot stop at just what you see. I saved you. But how did I get here? Why did I get here? Look to the true source. Understand that you cannot look at an incident in and of itself. You have to look at the entire sequence of events. How did this all come about? I've heard the story, and many of you probably can affirm this better than I can, how Rabbi Kosman of blessed memory ended up in Frederick. You guys remember the, yeah, this was not the top of his list of places to go to become into the rabbinate, right? What happened? He was learning in yeshiva, and his friend told him about a place further along. You should go check it out. Does everybody know this story? Right? Yes, no? And he stopped. He was told, oh, there's a small community. They can use somebody. So he stopped in. He figured he'd come by interim and see what he can do to help out. And he fell in love with the place 50 years later. That's how it works. Things don't, what's one of his favorite sayings? There are no
coincidences.
That's right. There's a sequence of events. Things don't just happen. They're part of a master plan. They're part of something bigger. And you have to be able to see that. And that is what Moshe was saying. I know it sounds funny. Go thank the dead Egyptian who I killed. But really the message, the lesson he's trying to impart to them is this is part of a bigger picture. And you have to be able to see that.
Part of a bigger picture.
Let's see. Let's explore this a little further, right? It's an important idea. All right, let's start with a simple one. We know that Moshe at the end of his life was not granted permission to go into the land of Israel, right? It's one of the sad parts of the story about his life. Obviously, as someone who's learned a lot over the years, and I continue to try to learn more, I've seen many, many insights that it is in obviously for the greater benefit that Moshe didn't go in for a variety of reasons. But a little part of me from the human side, emotionally, I feel bad for the guy. Like he worked so hard and that was really his one dream, was to take the Jews and take them into the land of Israel. Okay. But as is always the case, there needs to be a reason that precipitates the I hate to use the word punishment, but there must have been a cause that brought about the effect of him not going in. What sin, if I can use the word, what sin did Moses commit that warranted God saying, you will not enter the land? Does anybody remember what that sin was?
He struck a rock.
Very good. He was commanded to speak to the rock to bring forth water for the nation. And yet he went ahead and he struck the rock. Right? We're familiar with that story? Oh, but my dear friends, once again, text messages. Let's analyze the words a little more carefully. There's more to this story than you think.
I always wondered about that.
Yeah, I'm so glad. You're not the only one.
I always assumed it was because the people he was trying to lead just couldn't get their act together.
Okay, so why are you punishing him?
That's the part I never liked.
So there are many answers that are proposed. Let me give you the simple answer and then we'll take it the next step. The simple and I think the most obvious answer is he didn't do what God asked. He was given an opportunity to sanctify God's name by just speaking to the rock, which would have been a miracle of an unbelievable proportion. And he didn't follow the directive exactly as he was commanded. Now, for people like you and me, the fact that we were even close, we would be given full credit. But somebody like Moshe, somebody like Moses is held to a higher standard and deviating, albeit slightly. Yeah, for him, that's a big no-no, and therefore he was punished. That is the real, honest, simple answer. But let's read the words a little more carefully. Here's what we find. Okay, everybody's flipping out. There's no water. Right, the Jews start complaining. I know it rarely happens, but they start complaining that there's no water. What can we do? So Hashem tells Moshe to bring water forth by speaking to the rock. Okay, here's what the Torah says. It says, Moses took the staff from before Hashem as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, O rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock? Huh? Jews, pay up, pay attention. What do you want me to do? You want us to bring water from a rock? Then Moses raised his arm, struck the rock with his staff twice. Abundant water came forth, and the assembly and their animals drank. End result, did they get the water?
Yeah.
Absolutely. God performed a miracle. Water came forth from a rock, even though Moshe didn't do what he was supposed to. I'm going to read the verse again, and I want you to zero in. What does he say? Not just his action of hitting the rock, but what does he say that strikes you as...
We will, not God does.
Say that again?
We will, not God does.
Oh, now we're getting somewhere. Listen to the words again. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you from this rock? Which part don't you like?
We.
Now, if some of you didn't like the tone of voice that he's using, where he says, listen up, you rebels, you'd be in a good camp. Nachmanides is bothered by that term, that Moshe lost his cool and he started calling names to the Jewish people. God doesn't take kindly to that. That's it. Just make yourself a little note. Don't do it. Okay? but the other point is very clear. And that he says, listen, rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock? Who's we, Kimosabi? our sages point out that yes, again, for people like you and me, where it's clearly Moshe had not even an iota of a thought that he had the power and authority to bring water from a rock. It for sure was God. But when you utter something that could be misunderstood, again, on Moshe's level, that implied that you're in charge, you're taking credit for it, that's a no-no. That's a no-no. What he did wrong, which, yes, again, seems like a minor infraction, but what it does, it undermines the entire mission statement of what Moshe has been trying to do his whole life. His whole life was to teach the Jewish people one simple lesson. You have an issue, you have a question, you have a gripe, you have something you want, go to the source. Go to the source, God. I'm just a simple messenger. All the Jews are complaining. Moshe's like, what do you want from me? Turn to God. He's in charge, not me. Here, he uttered words that could be misunderstood. That undermines his whole mission. It becomes crystal clear once you understand this, the very end of the Torah, where the Torah gives, so to say, Hashem gives Moshe his last stamp of approval of what it is that he accomplished as a leader for the Jewish people. The very last verse of the Torah. Moshe was successful in making it clear to the Jewish people that all the signs and the wonders and everything that happened in the history were all from God. It wasn't me. Yeah, I physically lifted my staff and brought the plague, but it wasn't me. It was God. I raised my staff over the water and the sea split, but that wasn't me. It was God. very last verse reads as follows. The Torah giving the quality of Moshe. Never again has there arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom God had known face to face, as evidenced by all the signs and wonders that Hashem sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh and all of his officers and all his land. Listen to the line. And by all the strong hand and awesome power that Moses performed before the eyes of all Israel. Oh, what do you mean? All the strong hand and awesome power that Moses performed? Moses didn't perform anything.
Mm-hmm.
All the commentaries are up in arms. What do you mean? What do you mean? I believe it's Rashi right there on the verse that says all of this was that this was the indication that when Moses came down the mountain and saw them reveling around the idol, the golden calf, he took those 10 tablets and he smashed them. If you were God, would you be happy with that? I just gave you my most precious gift and you're coming down the mountain. Now I get it. I'm not happy. God up there is not happy with the Jewish people at that point. But who gave you permission to smash my Torah? That's a little presumptuous of you, Moses. The very last pasuk in the Torah, the very last verse tells us God gave him two thumbs up and says, Moshe, all that you performed, you kept banging home the message. There's a God, turn to God. There's a source to everything. Credit where credit is due. And the last verse says, Moses, you done did good. You done did great. In fact, just a few verses earlier where it talks about the last pretty much title that he's ever given, it says that Moshe, it's verse 5 if you're looking, it says, Vayamat Shem Moshe Eved Hashem, that there in on this mountain, right, Moses died, which Moses? Eved Hashem, servant of God. I don't know about you, but I grew up thinking that if you were a servant, that's the lowest end of the totem pole. Who wants to be a servant? I want to be the master. No, it depends who your master is. Yeah, if it's some yokel, if it's some human being, then yeah, being subservient to another human being, that's lowly, that's degrading. But if I told you, you know what your greatness is? Is you are the ultimate servant of God. Man. That's as great a compliment as anyone can ever get. You earn the title to be God's right-hand man. You are the most loyal and dedicated servant of God. What is a servant? A servant has nothing of their own. Everything about the servant is about the master. Moshe's entire mission was to teach us this lesson about turning to the source. With this, and I'll end with this, one of the most famous questions that's ever been asked, we now know an answer. We all sit around for the holiday of Passover, and we read from the most famous book called the Haggadah. The Haggadah tells over the story of the Exodus. We're all familiar with it. Some of us forget there's another part that goes after cups numbers 3 and 4, but we'll talk about that another time. Depends what. But there is a whole part there, okay? Alan, if I were to ask you, please name me who you would expect to find written in the story in the Haggadah about the Exodus, would you not expect to find Moshe's name in there?
Yep.
I would. Moses. I mean, come on. Exodus. Oh, Moses. It's like it just rolls off the tongue. Yet there's not one mention of Moshe's name in the Haggadah. That's not totally true. There is one mention of it, but it's just because it's citing a verse that has his name in it. But as far as telling the story, his name is nowhere to be found. At first, that should be shocking to you. What a bunch of ingrates we are. How do you leave out? We're going to tell over the whole story of the founding of the United States of America. And I'm not going to mention George Washington. I'm not going to mention Abraham Lincoln. What? That's part and parcel of who we are. Yeah, you're going to tell the story of the Exodus on the most pivotal night that we do this, of teaching the next generation, and oops, we leave out Moses? No. The answer is because it's the greatest praise to Moshe. If Moshe was to write the book, you think he would put his name in it? Who would be front and center? God. That's it. And therefore, perhaps the greatest praise for Moshe, showing the successful mission of attributing everything to God alone, yeah, we leave it out. These are the two lessons of what it means to be an Ish Mitzri, of an Egyptian man. On level one, on the first understanding, is that that's where it started. He started on an Egyptian man. But look where he grew to become. He grew into become an Ish Elokim, a man of God. One who gets his epitaph, reads Eved Hashem, a true loyal servant of God. Everything about him was attributing it to God. Not me. It wasn't me. I was a faithful servant. That's what I was. So yeah, I may have started as an Ish Mitzri, as an Egyptian man, but I grew, constant growth, to become a man of God. And number two, the beautiful analogy that you always have to look back and say, you know how I got here? Is because of what happened back there in Egypt. That Egyptian man who started up with a Hebrew that I went to defend and killed. Yeah. Look at the bigger picture. Don't judge the incident by itself. Recognize the entire sequence of events to see the hand of God in all of it. Those were the two messages. That's what it means to have the man going in the right direction. You're growing upwards constantly, and you also have your eyes upward to see the bigger picture in all of it. Those are the two parts of what it means to be a man in the right direction. Not to exclude the woman in the right direction, but that's the verse. So I just played off it. Questions?
Rabbi, I felt the topic could also, the man heading in the right direction could also be applied to Moses' father, Amram. Because originally he was going in the wrong direction when he divorced his wife and decided not to have any more children. But Miriam, his daughter, argued and convinced him that, no, you need to be married and you need to have future daughters and males. And he did the right thing and going the right direction by remarrying his wife and, of course, having children. And, of course, one of those children was Moses.
Very good.
So I felt that he was also heading in the right direction.
Excellent point. Excellent, excellent idea. There are many examples like that. You're 100% right, John. That's another great lesson. I only used the word man because I was looking for the word ish. It doesn't say that. It does say, by the way, about Amram, Moshe's father, when he first remarries his wife, it says, Vayelech ish, a man went and from the house of Levi and married a daughter of Levi. Doesn't even use their names. That's for another whole conversation about if you think you can't have somebody of great leadership and to become the next great person because you're just average. Yeah, the Torah goes out of the way not to tell us who Moshe's mother and father were until much later.
The same is true with Miriam's name. The same is true with Miriam's name. She's not identified initially either.
Right. She and Yocheved are given pseudonames. But even the mere fact of the Torah in that chapter is describing the birth of Moshe. Oh, my God. Who gets a child like Moshe? Must be the greatest man and woman to be at the time, which is true. They were amazing people. But the Torah doesn't say that's why Moshe. It's some man. A man went and he married some nice girl. Beautiful. Ah, right. He married his Bashert again. Ah, so beautiful, touching. I hear Fiddler in the Roof playing in the background. You know, it's just a guy. Yeah, because everybody has the ability, destiny for greatness. Everybody. Even your average-ish, average guy. Any other? Wonderful. All right. Great to see y'all. Have a wonderful rest of the week. A great Shabbos. And look forward to seeing you all next Tuesday for Aleph Bet and Wednesday for the next Parsha.